Welcome to UK Health Radio. You are listening to the Speech and Language Therapy Show, hosted by Shamina Rabi, a consultant speech and language therapist and founder of Unlocking Language, an award-winning independent practice that provides speech and language therapy to both adults and children. She is dedicated to raising awareness about speech, language, communication and swallowing difficulties and empowering those who have them.
So today on the show, we've got three fantastic speech and language therapists who work with pediatric feeding, swallowing, oral motor difficulties in the area of children aged 0 to 18. We've got Alana Wager with us, Sarah Watkins-Baker, and Mira Mehta. Hi, guys.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
It's very exciting because I know you've got some great news. You're all involved in something that's being launched over the next few weeks to do with pediatric feeding difficulties, pediatric dysphagia.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are launching the London Dysphagia Centre on Swallow Awareness Day. So that's going to be March 18th, 2020. So coming up soon. So it's been a progress in work for quite a while now. So I think we're all really excited to see it begin.
Swallow Awareness Day, what's that?
Yeah, so Swallow Awareness Day is a day that is specifically dedicated to raising awareness about individuals who experience dysphagia, so swallow difficulties, and that's going to be the primary focus of what we're chatting about today.
So before we get into the theory of what is dysphagia and what the centre is going to be offering, it would be great to have a bit more information about each of you, sort of your journey into speech therapy and your journey, I suppose, into the world of dysphagia.
Sure. So
we've got Alana now speaking.
Yes. So for me, dysphagia has been a big love of mine really since the beginning. So started training in speech and language therapy, what seems like forever ago, but wasn't. So completed my bachelor's degree in 2016 back in the US and then a master's degree in 2018. And dysphagia has kind of been a real bulk of my caseload and my love ever since then. So I was fortunate to have some really great placements where I was allowed to learn and experience a lot about pediatric dysphagia in inpatient and outpatient settings, both neonatal and up through the lifespan, really, into geriatric populations. So dysphagia has always been something I've really loved. I think that it's an area in our field that is still so sort of under-delivered in terms of clinical availability. And I think the other reason I love it too is because it's so wonderful to be able to provide support and knowledge to what feels like a very scary area for a lot of families. Not that communication difficulties themselves aren't frightening, but I think when things get into sort of the medical realm, there's an added urgency for support. So yeah, I've been hooked ever since. I love dysphagia support.
And I always find the reaction quite funny when you tell professionals, consultants, families that we work with, babies as young as 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Feeding difficulties, the real neonates.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, swallowing is a reflex that develops in utero. So in terms of neurological functions, it's one of the first things that we develop. And I think also there's actually been talk over the years, especially in the United States, about changing the name of our profession to speech, language, and swallow therapists.
Very long, though.
Yeah, I know, as if it's not long enough already. I think that's also a great point. That's something that people might not know, is that in terms of interprofessional collaboration and whose job it is to address swallow difficulties, that's a speech and language therapist's role. Yeah, so of course with ENT and gastro collaboratively, but that is definitely within our area of practice.
Great, okay, excellent. And so Mira, tell us a little bit about you.
Yes, so hi everyone, I'm Mira, a speech and language therapist, and I have been qualified for 6 years now, and I have a lot of interest in orofacial, facial muscles, orofacial myology, and totals. So all to do with the muscles of your face, the muscles of your tongue, the muscles of your mouth, and also Looking more into thumb sucking, so that's something that's really big. We get a lot of children that do thumb suck or do have dummies that they just can't give up on, and that's something that sometimes parents find a little bit more difficult. So I have an interest and a growing interest in this, and this is something that I'm really looking forward to doing and working on as well.
And I mean, we've had parents email asking for tips and strategies on how do I get my child to quit the dummy. They've got a three-year-old and they've just really sort of got addicted to it, and it, you know, it's hard being a parent, let's face it. So sometimes you just need to do what you can. It'll be great to get some top strategies from you, and I'm sure we could do another whole podcast on thumb sucking and using the dummy. And how did you go from speech therapist, generalist, to kind of working with Oromote and having an interest in what's happening around the mouth and the pharynx? And
So I have family that are dentists and specializing in sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, you're a speech and language therapist, why don't you look at orofacial myology as a course? So over my summer holidays, I decided to make my trip to Sydney, and do the course on orofacial myology. And the course was great. And the best thing is there's not a lot of speech and language therapists who also do orofacial myology in the UK. So we would be one of the first that can offer this service.
So you're an accredited therapist, and there's just a handful in the UK.
Yeah, not very many. So it's something that's still up and coming, and that we're trying to get people more aware of as well.
Fantastic. Awesome. Great.
Too funny, Mira. My dad is a dentist too. And my grandpa. Oh, really? Maybe there's a theme here with our dental colleagues.
And then we've got Sarah, who's back with us again, who did a fantastic podcast the other day with myself around sensory feeding difficulties in children with autism.
Yeah, we did. I'm Sarah. I also graduated with a bachelor's degree in speech and language pathology in 2016. And I think my kind of interest and love for dysphagia started at uni, but it kind of really grew when I went into my first role after I graduated, where I was based in a hospital, and I was lucky enough to get the opportunity to work with both pediatric and adult patients with dysphagia. And that included neonates, which I absolutely love. So I guess coming to the UK, I've been really lucky to have the opportunity to continue working with the pediatric dysphagia population and kind of expand and grow my knowledge. And then I recently, last year, did the SOS feeding approach course. That's working with children who are classified as picky eaters or problem feeders, and is linked to, you know, sensory aversions around food. Mm-hmm. So that's been really, really good to learn about that and start feeding therapy around that area.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds really exciting. So with a combination of your skill set, is born the London Dysphagia Centre.
Yeah.
So tell us about it. Why do we need this in London? What's it going to do? Who can access it? How can people be referred?
Yeah, so I think first of all, you know, our service came about really identifying gaps in the continuum of care for dysphagia, and also kind of, you know, recognizing that the reality is that with very long wait lists for public services, sometimes parents don't want to or can't wait until they're given an appointment with a specialist within their local NHS trust. So
the dysphagia waiting lists are quite good, though.
They are.
In the NHS, especially for assessment. I think they can get to them within a very quick time frame.
Yes, absolutely.
Is it more sort of the therapy side of things?
Definitely. It's that therapeutic approach. And then I think as well, you know, something that's great is to be able to offer second opinions too.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's best practice that all of us typically want a second opinion when it comes to anything with ourselves or definitely with our children. So that was really, I think, kind of like our basis in terms of a business model. And then I think from a logistical perspective, we just really enjoy having that flexibility of being able to offer parent trainings and collaborative workshops where parents can come in and learn strategies directly from us, things of those nature. So Sarah, do you want to talk about the referral?
Yeah, process. So the referral process, we've kind of, I think where we started was trying to identify local GPs and ENTs and dietitians and so on in the area that we can kind of create a referral pathway through, and kind of put ourselves out there and be like, here we are, we're ready for referrals. So that's kind of what we've been doing and how we've been kind of creating this pathway for hopefully people will refer it to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. And people can self-refer, I'll just add, through our website. So if you're concerned about your child's feeding, you can self-refer through our website.
So, Alana, can you give an example of, you know, a neonate that might come to clinic and then that would need your expertise and the complexity? Because you do deal with quite fragile and medical little ones, don't you? What sort of symptoms would they be displaying? How would somebody know that actually they need a speech and language therapist?
Great question. So typically with our neonates, we see the issues in terms of weight gain and also around observable behaviors in their feeding patterns. So for example, we might see a child who is experiencing failure to thrive. So they've got that low weight that's difficult to get up. They might have feeds that are too lengthy. So for a neonate, any feed that lasts longer than 30 minutes is not an efficient feed. The child's then burning more calories than they're taking in. So that's a major red flag. We think about other typical concerns for dysphagia in this population being things like red face after eating or drinking, for example, anterior loss. So when we can see loss of saliva or of milk from the front of the mouth during a feed.
And Irene, would we see that though with a baby that's sort of 6 months or under?
Yeah, sure we would. I think what I usually tell parents, you know, is use your judgment. If something feels, especially when it comes to, like you mentioned, something that those difficult behaviors, right, where sometimes they're normal and then sometimes they can be symptomatic of an underlying issue. And I find that usually the parents are always the ones with that awesome instinct that can kind of tick off to, like, for example, okay, I feel like this is more loss of milk from the front of the mouth than I was seeing with my first child, or that I feel like is normal.
Okay.
Other concerns would obviously be coughing or choking while consuming milk. And I'm trying to think, Sarah.
And what does that mean with the coughing and choking? So our listeners know, what does that actually mean when the baby or the child or toddler is coughing when they're drinking?
Yeah, so when we see or hear coughing when a child is consuming food or drink, that is a sign to us of airway compromise. Mm-hmm. And so basically what that means is that a foreign body, whether it's food or drink, is entering into the airway. So we have those two parallel tubes, one leading to the stomach, the esophagus, and the other, the trachea, leading to the lungs. And it's sort of this awesome automatic process that our brains have of helping us self-protect our airways. So when we swallow, our epiglottis flops down over the top of the trachea and keeps us safe from food and drink entering the lungs. But for children who are experiencing a neurological insult of any kind, so maybe that is a previous injury like cerebral palsy or a traumatic brain injury, a developmental disability or a genetic condition, sometimes those neurological reflexes aren't always intact.
Yeah.
And then we see airway compromise.
Okay.
So that's why that's a big concern for us.
And what would you do in that situation? What would parents expect? How do you treat the child, the baby?
Sure. Yeah. So the first thing that we would do is we would do a swallow assessment. So we always try and use the least invasive technique that is necessary for the child, right? So when our babies come in, we do a bedside, a clinical swallow eval, which is we basically observe them consume a bottle, consume a meal if they're at that age. And if we see signs or symptoms that indicate that airway compromise may be present, then we would make a referral always for an instrumental swallow evaluation. And that'll give us some more information specifically about what's going on and would inform our recommendations for therapy.
Mum and dad have come in to see you. They've got a 12-week-old who is not feeding or latching onto the breast that well. the neonate has got swallowing difficulties. What do you do then as a speech therapist? Once you've done the assessment, what can you do for treatment?
So there's a variety of things we can do for treatment. So first of all, let's give an example of an oral feeder. So a child that is consuming food orally, that doesn't have a feeding tube in place. If that's the case, what we really want to do is we want to use cue-based feeding techniques and also a lot of behavioral modification.
So cue-based is?
So cue-based would be things like basically just really paying attention to the child's physical movements and reactions to the feed, and based on that, trying things like positioning them in different ways. So for example, a midline position or an upright position, right? If we're getting some symptoms like that the child might be experiencing reflux after a feed. Another common technique we use in neonates is we tend to use different bottles and different nipple heads for the bottle. And what that allows us to do is it really allows us to control the flow rate of the milk. Okay. And then based on that, we often find that by using an appropriate flow rate, most children are able to protect their airways at least much more efficiently than they would be able to if they were, for example, using a standard size, a standard nipple.
Okay.
And those are just some examples, generic examples.
And how long would treatment take? Would it be a couple of sessions, or do they need to come in regularly to see you? What does the program sort of look like?
Yeah, so it really does depend. I know no one likes to hear this answer. It really does depend on every child, right? But I think typically...
It is bespoke, I do agree. I think speech therapy really is bespoke.
It really is, especially with feeding. So, I mean, we can have kids that come in and let's say, for example, if it is an issue where like we can really identify and isolate that it is a flow rate issue, right? Mm-hmm. With like the bottle and the nipple that that child is using, then in that session, we would trial a bunch of different ones. We'd find the one that seems to work the best for the child. Mm-hmm. And then we would follow up, right? So follow up on a weekly basis. And if there's no concerns from a health, a chest health or a weight gain perspective, that child could be discharged from our caseload or could put on a re-eval only sort of therapy approach. And that'd be really different than like, for example, some of the patients we see for sensory feeding, where it's much more sort of consistent and regulated.
And you're working sort of, Sarah, with you know, all the people that are involved with that child, so school and home, you know, after school club, so that everyone can support that child with sensory feeding difficulties.
Exactly. So obviously we always eat throughout the day, so the child's going to eat at home, they're going to eat at school, they're going to eat at afternoon club. So we need to make sure that each person that's with them in that environment is able to support them in the right ways. So like, you know, you said having correct positioning or having the correct consistencies or food that the child can tolerate, and then, you know, if there's a sensory aversion, being able to support them using strategies that we can provide them with.
And how early on can you detect sensory feeding difficulties in a child or a toddler?
Well, that's something we were actually talking about the other day. Yeah. For example, like neonates that have been tube fed or neonates with reflux that can lead to sensory aversions later on in life. Mm, so definitely. That it can start fairly early. And that's why we like to see those as young as possible.
Absolutely.
Because to try prevent those sensory aversions. Exactly like with the case you saw the other day about getting sensory stimulation while the child is being tube fed, so that they're able to hopefully tolerate foods and textures later on if they do start eating orally.
Absolutely.
And can you give us an example of a child that you've worked with, kind of from assessment to maybe sort of end of therapy, how many sessions it's taken, or the outcome of how it's been?
Mm. Yeah, sure. So if I think of, let me think of a child quickly. So I had a child in a school that was only eating, had got stuck on pureed foods, and the specific pureed food that he liked was Cerelac.
How old was the child?
He was 8 years old,
Okay.
Mira actually knows this one.
Okay, so 8 years he just eats Cerelac.
Cerelac.
For breakfast, lunch and dinner?
Yeah.
Or?
And what kinds of things would the parents see, Sarah, like if he was presented with anything else?
He would just refuse to eat it, pull a face, maybe push it away, not look at it. So very difficult to try and to eat anything else. So went in to the school for an assessment. And this is, like we said earlier, observing the child eat what they would normally eat. And then seeing if they have the right skills for his age, so at, you know, 8 years old, we expect him to have all the right oral motor skills for eating and swallowing.
So like chewing and being able to put your lips around the spoon, and take it off the spoon.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then also kind of seeing how he responds to other foods that he hasn't tried before. So that was a typical, so mostly observation, but then a little bit of playing around with what would happen, you know, if we had to put spaghetti in front of him and what he would do. And then from that I could kind of create a program specific for that child, and it was basically a food exploration program that we developed and put together for the TA to help us.
TA is the teaching assistant,
to run on a regular basis. And that was just basically learning about food, learning about the different textures, the consistencies, the properties of the food. So what does it look like? What does it smell like? What does it taste like?
So how would this work practically? So does the teaching assistant put the food there and then they talk about it like it's like they play with it?
So we use a graded approach. So the first first step is that the food will tolerate, I mean the child. The food in the room. So some children have very strong aversions, and if they see a food they will immediately turn away or have a meltdown. They can't even look at it. So and then you slowly build it up so they'll tolerate it on their plate, then they'll tolerate.
So how do you build it up? How do you
Through exploring and basically playing with food, which obviously is sometimes a little bit, people are like, oh, but we always taught not to play without food. But that's the best way, children learn through play. So that's the best way for the children to learn about food and to kind of say, hey, I'm not scared of this.
Definitely.
And then we work it up to eventually touching it, to holding it, to changing it, and then smelling it, and then hopefully eating and swallowing it.
And how long did it take for this child to...
I'm trying to think. And within our first session, so obviously it's very dependent on the specific child. But he was an A-plus student and he was ready to go from the first session.
And what's the diagnosis of this child?
Autism.
Okay.
Yeah. So he, within the first session, he tried, I think, two foods, which he actually tasted, which was great for the first session. Obviously, other children take much longer to move up those steps. So for him, it was fairly quick, I would say.
Yeah, what I thought was really interesting, because I was there when you did the assessment, was even though he had his Cerelac in front of him, you still had a plate of food that everyone else was eating.
Yeah.
Everyone else on the table was eating it, even though he didn't touch it. In the middle of his meal, you started talking to him about it and playing with the spaghetti, and he was showing interest in it. So I thought that was quite nice.
Yeah.
When you talk about your graded system, he was able to tolerate it straight away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that is something for parents, is even if your child only eats a specific food, still present them with the food that you have on the table that you eat.
Give them that choice.
Yeah.
Because you can still talk about it and you can still interact with it, and hopefully the child will show interest even if they don't want to eat it.
And that's really interesting from a sensory perspective too, because I think we think about like learning through exposure, right? And like I've had a lot of parents tell me, for example, like with trying different foods, like, oh, okay, you know, this is what's for dinner, but my son won't eat this, so I'm going to give him, you know, his pasta with butter and salt. And although we totally get that, and that does make sense, right? If you've had an experience where they've rejected all other foods, you know, you're not going to present something that's going to be rejected.
Yeah, because your primary concern is I want my child to eat.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Get their nutrition.
Absolutely. But it's interesting because like from another perspective, right, we wouldn't say, okay, for example, this child has a limited amount of vocabulary, so I'm not going to use this certain word around them, or I'm not going to expose them to other things that they might not understand yet. But from a food perspective, right, often we kind of, and then what we're doing is we're really reinforcing like those limitations and those stringent rules and behaviors around food for the child.
Exactly.
But how can we implement that as working parents? So, you know, I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old and I just want them to eat their food, because that whole 1 hour is survival mode. Let's just get them eating and drinking.
Yeah.
So then to start thinking, right, I need to show them this. this and I need to get them to. Sure. How can we fit that into normal routine as parents, whether we work or not? Because it, you know, we have so many challenges as parents.
A great way to do food exploration and learning about food is food preparation. So you can be prepping dinner or you can be prepping lunch.
Yeah.
And the best way you can get the is to get the child involved in that.
That's a good idea.
Let them, you know, mix the flour and the eggs, or stir what it is in the pots, or obviously supervise. Cut out the, you know, bread or cheese or bread, you know, anything. Get them involved and talk about what, you know, like you say to parents with, you know, language disorders, you know, talk to your child.
Yeah,
and sure, that's the same thing we're going to do here. Talk
absolutely
about what you
need. So expose your child to different
things. And you get a helper.
I know.
What you were saying, I remember when you were seeing this client, you said that they need to try it a certain number of times before they reject it.
Yeah, and this is for all children, typically developing children and non-typically children. Science has shown that when you're introducing a new food, it needs to be presented at least 10 times before the child will accept that new food.
So that's really interesting.
This is on 10 different occasions, so not just let me present it over and again now. It needs to be on 10 separate meals. You need to represent that food to them.
That's how I feel about sushi. Okay, so Mira, tell us about your role in the centre. So we've got, you know, the kind of like neonate complex medical fragile children with organic dysphagia that Alana sort of sees, and then we've got the sensory feeding and the SOS approach delivered by Sarah. So what is your role here in the clinic?
So I have been, like I said earlier, I've been trained on orofacial myology and working with children kind of from 3 onwards. But another thing that I'm also trained on is Talk Talk, which is an American speech and language therapy program that works on orofacial muscles, your tongue muscles, and your speech as well. So it's how it's all linked together.
Samira, when you talk about talk tools, what do you mean that it works with oromotor skills, oromotor muscles?
Sure.
What actually are talk tools?
So talk tools, like I said, is an American program. And when I say works on oromotor, I meant working on your tongue lateralization, your tongue movement, your tongue strength, which is also could be linked with tongue ties, and also your facial muscles and your lip closure. So we get a lot of children that are coming in and parents saying they're drooling, we don't know how to stop them, what could we do? And talk tools is a really good tool to support that. So we have a way to assess the children and see what their baseline is, set some targets, work jointly with the parents, which is really important because it's an exercise that needs to be done daily. It's not something that can just be done once a week. So we want to use talk tools as a holistic approach, and it is important that your therapists are trained on talk tools because there's different levels.
Okay.
So if you do have, or if you are referring your child to a talk tools therapist, it would be good to check the website as well to see the levels.
And talk tools works on speech, feeding, and managing your saliva, and just developing and building the strength of those oromotor muscles, oromotor skills.
Yeah.
All those skills and muscles you mentioned are really important for feeding.
Absolutely. And I've worked with them. With talk tools, I've worked with a large number of kind of client base or with different diagnoses. So I've had a client that has had cerebral palsy. I've had a few clients that have autism as a diagnosis.
So I can see with with cerebral palsy, with Down syndrome, the child naturally has got low tone, weak muscles. But with a child with autism, tone and muscle is normal.
Yeah.
So what's your role there then?
So one of the things that Talk Tools does have or is equipped with is the apraxia kit. So we get a lot of parents coming in and saying, you know, we really want our child to start speaking, or he has a few words or he has a few sounds, but we want that to develop a little bit further.
Or they want just sounds as
or
well.
Or they just want sounds developed. So the apraxia kit works on the auditory, the kinesthetic, and the kind of sensory feedback that you get. And so do lots of the other tools that the talk tools have. So it's a whole base of flutes that we can use, which work on specific speech sounds, phonation, and also learning how to fill up your air with fill up your lungs with air, because that's one of the biggest things.
The breath support.
It's huge. Lip control. So we get a lot of children that aren't able to blow a bubble. When you think about the lip formation that you're making when you blow a bubble, children can't do it. So we teach them, and there's different ways to teach them how to blow bubbles as
well. So you're working on the non-verbal skills before we even want to start working on those verbal skills.
Exactly.
Excellent, great. And so tell me more about the oromyofunctional therapy and the thumb sucking. What's the link here?
So like I said earlier, we get a lot of children that, or as a speech and language therapist working on speech, I get a lot of children that have delayed speech sounds, so, or they may have a lisp, and I say, you know, your child is 4 or 5, is he still using a dummy? And I've had a lot of parents saying, yeah, actually, you know, he is using a dummy.
So at 4 or 5, you're still getting children through different dummies.
Exactly. So that's one of the biggest triggers. Your child is using a dummy. We need to help you to support your children to quit using the dummy.
Sure.
But as we know, it's hard, and it's hard to it's hard for parents to just take the dummy away and let them just carry on. So that's one of the things we work on. We work on supporting your children to stop using their dummy. Children that use their dummy also maybe thumb sucking, which is a really big thing.
Well, can you have children that just thumb suck as well, that don't necessarily use a dummy, or is there a name?
Okay. So I think you can have a variation. You can have some children that do thumb sucking and dummy, or some children that just do thumb sucking. The reason we get a lot of children thumb sucking is because, firstly, it starts in your womb. That's something that I learned on the course. It's not, I wouldn't have ever thought of it. Children use it as a cooking.
That's interesting. So do all babies sort of suck on their thumbs when they're in the womb?
Yeah, so thumb sucking begins in the womb, and babies are genetically wired to suck for nutrition. So again, you know, we're talking about the swallow, and they start swallowing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before birth. Sucking the thumb for especially for babies is a coping mechanism for comfort and for wellness and for their anxiety as well. Right. And when they're separated from their parents.
Sure.
So maybe kind of the age 3 or 4, you get children going into nursery school.
Absolutely.
And as a comfort, they're using that as a, you know, they're
self food. Yeah. And I think this makes so much sense too, because if we look at it from a perspective of what's the first soothing, bonding experience between a mom and a baby, right? It's the feed.
Yeah.
So then it's no mystery why, like, the dummy is the magic trick to a tantrum, to a bad day, to an exhausted toddler, right?
Yeah.
And the same with thumb sucking too, because the thumb is really like an organic dummy that's attached to the body.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, and I think that's the reason why, like, this is so hard, is when it becomes that coping mechanism for your child that doesn't have the language yet to, like, articulate when they need maybe support after a tough day, for example, or can't even realize it yet.
And another fun fact about thumb sucking, it's it triggers your happy hormones, so it's like you said, it's
interesting. Also, an endorphin thing. Interesting.
Yeah.
So what's so you've got a child who's you know, who's sucked their thumb for 4 years. Mm. How are they going to appear when they come to clinic? Is their dentition any different?
So I should have mentioned earlier, with children that are thumb sucking, or dummies, or using dummies as well as say 3, 4, even 5, they may have been referred to us by dentists.
Yeah.
And that's because of their dental position. Their teeth aren't in the position that they should be at, or their tongue position as well. So a lot of children that we get are mouth breathers. When I say mouth breathers, I mean they're, you know, at rest our lips should be closed with our tongue tip at the top of our mouth. But when we get children that are mouth breathers, their lips are open, and their tongue is slightly sticking out in between their teeth. So you can see that they're struggling to breathe as well,
and that's become a habit now because of having something in their mouth.
It's become a habit. It then is all interlinked, because you're thinking about their mouth position, you're thinking about the way they're breathing. If you're struggling with your breathing, You're also going to struggle with sleep.
Yeah.
If your sleep is affected, you're then going to struggle with kind of everyday activities.
Self-regulation, your mood.
Also speech, which is such a big one. So when we work on thumb sucking, we also then follow up with a speech program.
So it impacts directly on speech. And does it impact on feeding?
Yeah, it would impact on feeding as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the link with the oral myofunctional therapy and tongue tie? Because is that right that you'll also be working with babies, toddlers who have tongue tie?
Yeah. So we get a lot of children, or in the past I've seen a lot of parents that have said, oh, I didn't even know my child had a tongue tie.
Mm.
But again, your tongue strength is so important in latching on when, you know, during breastfeeding.
Definitely.
And also thinking about the muscles of your cheek. When you are breastfeeding, you're trying to strengthen the muscles of your cheek. But if children have a tongue tie, they're not going to be able to strengthen these muscles. So again, identifying whether children do have a tongue tie early on.
And Ilana, how could a mum, how could a mum start suspecting, oh, I wonder if my little one does have a tongue tie?
What are the sort of signs? And again, it's different and it does depend on the child. But some red flag signs are a baby that has a real difficult time latching, and also a baby that has a difficult time sustaining that latch.
Okay.
Right? So latching is hard. We all know that. Like, latching is hard for everyone. But it's when we see those babies that just, they cannot sustain the latch. Like, they get on and then they're slipping off
within a few seconds,
okay. and it keeps happening, and it happens consistently.
And so what is the tongue tie doing?
So what's happening in that instance is that the strength and the range of motion is limited.
Mm.
So the baby may be able to latch and to grab on. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And also depending on how severe the tongue tie is, they may also be able to protrude and to cup the tongue enough to establish a latch. But it's just so laborsome and difficult for them, if they're even able to sustain at all, right? So that's when we see. So that's probably, I would say, one of the biggest red flags is if we're seeing a latch that can be sustained, can be initiated, but cannot be sustained. The child is needing to relatch several times during a feed.
Yeah.
Symptoms of that, unfortunately, would be extremely painful feeds for mom, right? So some level of discomfort is normal with breastfeeding, but when it's getting to the point where, like, nipples are cracked and bleeding and really, really painful, I would definitely look into the presence of a tongue tie. I would say those are two of the big ones.
Yeah.
And so if that is the case, then the mum, dad, they can get in touch with a lactation nurse.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I think it's consultants and some lactation nurses that can cut the tongue tie.
Yeah, absolutely. So they use a procedure called a frenectomy.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they'll do is the tongue tie, if we think about what it actually is, it's that tiny little bit of skin that we all have under our tongue. Actually don't love the term tongue tie because we all have tied tongues, thankfully. But it's just when it becomes a functional problem. So depending on the facility, they will either snip it surgically,
mm-hmm.
or some places use laser ablation.
Okay.
So it's just typically a quick outpatient thing, in and out, and it's repaired in a day.
And what's your role then with the tongue tie?
Yeah, so primarily our role is in the early stages. So parents will come to speech and language therapists and to feeding therapists when they've got concerns, feeling like, okay, something isn't right here, mm-hmm. In terms of tongue tie, being quite suspicious that something might be atypical. And then we will assess, and then based on our assessment, we will refer as necessary to the ENT, so the otolaryngologist, who would ultimately perform the procedure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Okay. So I've got some questions that I've been emailed over the last few months from parents.
Great.
I'm just gonna sort of come out with them.
Okay. Great.
And anyone can respond. Someone has actually asked, what are the top tips or strategies to Mira to help with thumb sucking?
Mm-hmm.
So they've got a 5-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
They have actually sent a picture, a photo in where the teeth are. So there's a gap between the upper teeth and the lower teeth.
Okay.
What can they do to help reduce or really get rid of the thumb sucking.
So you might be wondering if it's a habit and whether it's going to continue or if it's going to, you know, if you're going to be able to stop it.
Sure.
This is the thumb sucking. Yeah. When I was taught about thumb sucking on the orofacial myology course, the clinician mentioned, or they taught us and said, it's like a habit that you can't get rid of. So, for example, a bad habit or a habit that you want to quit.
Sure.
So with thumb sucking, it's a program that where we work with the child and with the orthodontist as well to stop them from their thumb sucking. It's a program that would take about... It's a long-term program where we would see the child once every 2 to 3 weeks, or it could be a little bit longer depending on how they're coping with it, and we help them wean off their thumb sucking. So we have different things like thumb guards that we can use. And another thing is a lot of children that do thumb suck have something that is their comfort. So I've seen children that have like a little blankie that they come with or a little teddy bear. Yeah. So one of the things, obviously I can't give you all the tips because but one of the things that we would do is help them kind of or remove that addiction and that
replace attachment it with,
and then replace it with another positive behavior.
Okay.
We use a lot of rewards. So kind of behavior management with the thumb sucking as well.
One thing I'll say with that too that I think is really interesting is, and I can just even remember this, not through any clinical experience, but just like anecdotally from school, it very quickly becomes quite a socially isolating thing for children, doesn't it? Like the thumb sucking. Yeah. It can be a real cause for social isolation and for bullying, even amongst young children. When you think about like some of the first insults that young children throw at each other, it's always calling the other child a baby.
Yeah,
isn't it? And that's like one of the number one things that we equate to immature or baby-like behaviors, thumb sucking.
Yeah. Okay, so we've had a dad send an email.
Sure.
And he has a 2-year-old who eats and drinks fine at home, but as soon as they're in a social setting, so if they're going out to a restaurant or if they've gone to someone's house, the toddler has a meltdown and just is not eating or drinking in social situations. They're concerned that there are social communication difficulties as well.
Sure.
But what could they do to support, just to sort of help their little one to feel more comfortable in a social environment?
So I think it's looking at the cues to eating that are used at home. So for example, who's feeding the child? Where are they eating? What are they using to eat, in terms of utensils? Is there something, in the background while they're eating? So looking at the environment and then kind of thinking, okay, well, what's different at home? And then, for example, the restaurant. And sometimes it's things like just having a plain plate, cup and spoon that they can use. And if that's taking you with the restaurant to kind of use the same cues to eating, maybe that will help. I don't know, Alana, if you have any other...
I would recommend that as well. And I think, too, one thing that's interesting from like an environmental perspective is thinking about those sort of behaviors around eating and what are we as the adults reinforcing. So I think just from like if we look at it from like a behavioral standpoint, one of the first and really only forms of control that children have over their own lives is that power of refusal, right? Yeah. The power of no. I might not be able to make certain choices at 2 or 3 or 4 years old, but I can choose to not do this and not eat this, right? So I think that, looking to it, the way we respond to that, because children, whether there's a social communication difficulty or not, I think it's definitely fair to say that children understand much more than we give them credit for, especially in terms of our behavior.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's quite possible that the child may have picked up that when they're outside of the home, there is a different expectation on their feeding behavior. Mm-hmm. There might be a performance expectation, right? You're going to eat. We're at a restaurant. You need to eat compared to at home. Mm-hmm. And also thinking about like, how do we rewrite that experience? If a child has had stressful and negative experiences eating outside the home previously for any reason, how are we going to rewrite that experience and change it and make it different so that the child now, you know, is thinking about this in a totally different light. And I think this is the cool thing. Like, this is where parents can get creative, right? So maybe it's ordering a meal and the child, depending on the age and depending on family preferences for table manners, right? But that the child can play with or explore or try something new. Or maybe the child gets to, like, go somewhere and order a dessert, right? Something they absolutely love, and there's no pressure on them at all.
And you would say start off with that then. So if we have got this 2-year-old, start off with ordering what they like.
Absolutely.
Rather than going for a main meal and then...
Absolutely, okay. Right? And it sounds like such a simple suggestion, and that's because it is, but it works. We want to rewrite, like, that experience for the child.
Yeah.
You know, so...
And that is what you say about creating those positive experiences.
Yeah.
So before 6 months, feeding and eating is all... It's very... instinctive.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
We've got those reflexes in place, and it's after 6 months, it then becomes more of a learned behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it does.
Children can very quickly develop these negative associations with food in certain environments. So it's about trying to create those positive associations and experiences for them.
Definitely.
Great. So I've had an email from somebody in Lebanon, and they don't have access to speech and language therapy services.
Okay.
Now, she had a baby that was born 3 months early.
Okay.
So didn't really have the suck reflex.
Yeah.
I mean, the baby is now sort of 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
But in that instance, what could she have done, and do we have a role with a baby that is born premature, and what can we do to help get that swallow reflex going?
Do you know if this baby was on a tube feed by any chance?
Yes,
okay,
NG.
Yeah. Okay, great. So that would be what I would expect. So we definitely have a role with children who are not yet eating orally. And the reason for that is we want to be able to provide oral stimulation even to non-oral feeders, right? So stimulation to and around the mouth so that when children, our hope is always that when a feeding tube goes in, we want to think about the plan for how to take that tube out.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's completely up to the discretion and the professional expertise of the medical team and the doctor in that circumstance. That's not our call. But for therapeutic purposes, that's always what we're looking at, that next step forward. So for any baby that is tube fed, it is great to be able to provide that oral, intraoral, so in the mouth, and perioral, meaning around the mouth, stimulation for the purpose of avoiding, hopefully, any refusal or oral hypersensitivity in the future to oral feedings when they do eventually transition off the tube. So that's something that mom absolutely could be doing. Again, it's really important that you do this under the expertise of your medical team and
absolutely.
Under supervision to make sure that all of those precautions with respect to the child's medical issues are being respected. But that's definitely something we can do. And we see a lot of children who are NPO, right, so are no by mouth and tube fed, develop real sensory aversions. So whether it's behavioral refusal.
Because they've not had enough oral stimulation.
Absolutely. Hyperactive gag reflex. It's like, it's such a foreign concept. If you imagine, it might be difficult for us even to imagine, but if you just take a second and imagine if you've never eaten or had a drink through your mouth before.
So what sort of oral stimulation exercises would you provide?
Yeah, so it really varies, but in general, what we try to do is we try to just provide oral stimulation of any kind that the child will tolerate and accept.
So could that just be a thumb?
Yeah, absolutely. So for us, it could be a gloved finger tapping on the lips. Again, we're singing, we're communicating. It's a positive experience. We're tapping into that communication piece too. Sometimes it's a gentle massage. If we see that a child has already developed an aversion, we would automatically try to target towards that, right? So like if we see, for example, one of the most common ones is a hyperactive gag reflex. So kids that have tube feeds in place don't like anything in or around the mouth. I've had patients before that would gag if I brush them on the cheek, right? So then we work on building up that child's tolerance incrementally and over time. So for this little kiddo, for example, some of our sessions looked like me briefly singing a song to him, and we would have like a little tap and dance component where I would gently kind of like tap up his little arms, right? And then getting onto the neck. And initially he'd gag as soon as I went beyond the neck onto the face. So for a while, that's where we stopped. And then we built it up. And then it eventually got to the point where he would allow me to sort of do this little song and the little dance, and I could tap the tip of his tongue and he wasn't gagging anymore. So it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And if you think about those really tolerance skills, yeah, mm-hmm. it was fantastic. And it took time. Mm-hmm. This was over the course of probably 4 months.
Okay.
But it was incredible progress and it really supported him. He still has a tube feed in place, but it allowed him to have the skills to be able to also accept food through the mouth under the guidance of the medical team. So it was great.
Thank you. Just a couple more questions left.
Sure.
A mum's emailed that she has a 3.5-year-old, mm-hmm. does not have a diagnosis yet, suspected perhaps autism.
Okay.
He only has pureed foods. And she's struggling with him being able to chew. So what can she do to be able to support him to start chewing?
I'll take this one. So you said, how old was he?
3.5. And he'll have anything that's pureed, but he just doesn't want to chew.
Yeah,
so is he being lazy, or is it that he hasn't got the skills, or is it a combination of everything?
Yeah, so basically there's a lot of developmental shifts that happen from when you're a baby and as you grow up and, you know, get older.
Sure.
And sometimes at these developmental shifts, children can get stuck. And in this example, he's obviously gotten stuck on purees.
Yep.
But it's very difficult to tell without an assessment whether it's a sensory thing or if it is, an oral motor skill deficit. So that's something we would have to look for in the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would be able to, go forward from there.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a sensory thing, it would be, again, things like food exploration, trying to move on from the puree food might start if it's a, very severe version, might start just making small changes to the puree, things like that.
Mm.
But again, creating those positive experiences around food and introducing new foods. If it's an oral motor skills deficit, then you have to work on skills like chewing and tongue lateralization.
How would you work on chewing?
So we might bring in other approaches, like
tools.
Exactly. So Mira's spoken a bit about that and how that kind of works on those kind of skills.
Mm.
Also things that you can work on is through the SOS approach, they talk about hard munchables.
Yeah.
So these are foods that are solid foods that are basically children can't take a bite off,
mm-hmm.
and it's about them, so like a beef jerky or a carrot stick or something, those foods that are really hard.
Yeah.
And it's basically letting them explore that in the mouth. So you might dip it in the puree and then, they might put it in their mouth and dip it from side to side, things like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Obviously under supervision, because again,
sure.
So it would definitely depend on what the assessment findings would tell us, but that's basically.
And can you get children, who are not chewing, either due to sensory difficulties or oral motor deficits, to chewing?
Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
So it's a learned skill, and it's part of our, typical development. We eventually learn to chew and things like that. So we can definitely help work on that and get them chewing.
And one thing I think is interesting is this is a common problem that we see with a lot of our kids with ASD.
Yeah.
Is that difficulty accepting the sensation of chewing.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen this exact same issue many times before. We don't like that feeling, or we might not like the sound that we get from chewing into food and tearing into it that comes from the inside of our head. Like that's a highly sensory experience.
If you're hypersensitive, if you have a child that's hypersensitive, especially to noise, they might absolutely freak out when they hear themselves chewing or hear another person chewing.
Absolutely. And that's something too we would consider, like in therapy with this kid. I would be curious to see, for example, like if he would accept something like a yogurt stick or a cheese stick, something that's not crunchy, doesn't give as much of that auditory feedback when you chew into it.
Mm-hmm.
Just an example. Like
from a total's point of view, thinking about the adjustability.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just
before, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Before maybe trying these hard foods, looking at the digestibility, looking at what strength of chewy tubes they can use, because
absolutely.
That could be like
the early stage
program.
First.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. So how do people get in touch with you? What's the name of your web, your company?
The Center? Dysphagia Center.
London Dysphagia
London
Center.
London Dysphagia Center.
So I will put a link with the podcast that we'll put out. And then listeners can get in touch with you if they have any questions around dysphagia or
absolutely.
Feeding or eating difficulties. It's been great to have you all on.
Yes. And one final note.
Yeah, sure. Please.
To parents who have a child with dysphagia is that you're not alone. It's such a stressful experience. And there are people who, like us, and many other great people who are not us, who are here to support and help you. So just know that.
Lovely. Well, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
And just from this conversation today, I feel like we could have separate podcasts, just thumb sucking, breastfeeding, tongue tie, sensory all over again. So it'd be great to have you on again.
Yeah.
Thanks, girls.
Yeah.